All right, welcome to the Nurse Stories Podcast. Today we're doing something a little bit differently. We're getting stories from across the nation, and these individuals won't be present, but you'll hear their story, and then you're going to see my reaction to them as we get going. Like all of our podcasts, we want to give a shout out to our sponsor, which is Five Square Aesthetics. Five Square Aesthetics is a company devoted to getting nurses into aesthetics. So if you ever had the inkling to go and do Botox and fillers and start your own side hustle and make some good money, Five Square Aesthetics is where you're going to reach out. They'll get you your medical director, discounted supplies. They'll get you all the training you need, everything that you need to get into that field. So thank you, Five Square, for sponsoring this rendition. So we're going to go ahead and dive into this, and let's hear our first story.
I was early in my psych nursing career at a crisis stabilization unit. Cops brought in a guy for a 5150 for lying in the middle of the street. He claimed that very spot was his legal home. He proved it by having a pizza delivered there.
A pizza delivered to a spot in a city, and that's a proof of a legal home. Okay, well, that's interesting. I don't know how, I guess he did have an address if a pizza can get delivered there. So sometimes the delusional people are very clever, and you wonder, man, what would it be like if they could actually function in society? If they're that smart to work the system, what could they do if they actually put their mind to something more productive? But, you know, there's always a screw loose or two, and psych nurses have all the best stories in the world. So let's hear the next story.
We had surgery on someone who was abusive to their spouse. The patient collapsed and came to us with Fournier gangrene and COVID. We were doing surgery, and the patient's spouse said they were DNR. We had legal and ethic committee working to decide if we should take the spouse's word for it. After all, who wouldn't want their abuser to die? Since they were married, the spouse was the one who could make medical decisions. The patient coded, and we honored the wishes. Our surgeon called to inform the spouse that the patient died. The spouse hung up and refused to answer any calls after. Ethics and legal said we were safe, but it gave us all weird feelings.
The do not resuscitate order, the DNR order. So ethics are interesting in the hospital. In fact, the hospital I worked at, we had a person who was in charge of ethics. And ethics is that area where it's this area between the law and what's right. And it's a very gray area. And when you, and we ran into ethical situations all the time, like this is an example of one. And you literally, this person's job was to come in and talk to the providers, and you have an ethics meeting. And you're like, okay, what's ethically the right thing to do? Just like this nurse had experienced. And sometimes those are interesting situations. Like I haven't been involved in too many ethical dilemmas in my nursing career, but I've heard of one. There was one where a young person came in and had been abused, just like this. Just like this woman in this story that we just heard, and was going to end up dying. The ethical dilemma was, should we allow the parents who put this child, it was a burn, like the parent had poured hot water on their child and burned most of their skin, and you'd get dehydrated, infected, and all that kind of stuff. And this child, it was 2 years old, died. Whether the parent should be allowed to see the child before they died. And they did allow that to happen. You're kind of thinking, she doesn't deserve to see their child, but she had a mental problem, and that's why, you know, it's just this really weird area. I do remember an ethical situation. This did happen while I was in nursing school, of all places. Your very first rotation in most nursing programs is they put you in like a nursing home, where you go in and you help feed people and clean people and take care of them. Not an acute unit, but a long-term nursing home type of unit. And my very first day at this unit, which it was not my area of nursing, and God bless all you nurses that are working in that, in those situations, because it's kind of a hard unit, very understaffed. There had apparently, before I had before I had joined that unit, they had a, one of the residents became really good friends with one of the nursing staff. It was a certified nursing assistant, CNA. And for whatever reason, they fired the CNA. Well, this person was dying, and one of her last wishes was she wanted the CNA to come visit her. And the institution was like, she's not allowed on the premises. Well, the law says if you're in a health institution, you can see whoever you want to see. And so they had to get an ethics committee together, and they all agreed that this patient had the right to see this caregiver. It was her friend, even though the institution didn't want her on premises. I think she stole money or something. I'm not 100% sure. And I remember I was there the day that this person came in to see this resident, because, you know, she'd been taking care of this resident for 10 plus years. And security escorted her to the room, and they spent a couple hours together, and then security escorted her out. And that was the ethical dilemma. So ethics are really interesting in nursing and in hospitals, because not everything's well defined. One more ethical story, probably going on a little bit long. This made big news 10 years ago. There was a person in Florida, I believe, who came to the emergency room and had a heart attack or something like that. And they went to go shock this person. They opened up his chest, and on his heart was "Do not resuscitate" tattooed. Okay. Do not resuscitate. And so they have the shocker, and they're looking at this, and they're like, does this constitute this patient's wishes? I mean, he actually went in and put "do not resuscitate." And so they kept him alive, you know, through IVs and stuff like that. You know, his heart was still pounding, but he was fading fast. And so they convened an ethics board real quick, and the ethics people came in, and they said, yeah, that's probably his wishes, and they let him die. And so and he probably could have sued them if they did resuscitate him. Like, you, they take that very seriously. If you have a do not resuscitate order and you resuscitate somebody, you can be legally liable. So but anyways, gray areas. Holy smokes, are there a lot of gray areas in healthcare? But interesting story. All right, let's hear the next one.
Too many stories. I'll pick the gangbanger trauma GSW chest and abdomen. Also got his diaphragm, as I recall. So the acute period is over. He's had all his surgeries. He's extubated and off drips, just some drains and chest tubes. But the delirium has him. I'm sitting at the desk near his room charting when I hear him yelling for the doctor. I look up, and this dude is standing on the bed, waving bloody chest tubes in one hand, Foley in the other, screaming for a doctor.
Holy smoke. There's nothing worse than nursing when patients go crazy. And they could be the sweetest old lady, and you get the wrong med in them, or they get sick, or they get sepsis, and their mentation changes, and they can go from angel to Beelzebub, like devil incarnate in a quick. And losing a tube is horrible. So a chest tube is keeping the lungs inflated, right? And Foley's draining the bladder. If you pull a Foley out, there's 10 cc's or 10 milliliters of fluid in a bubble in the bladder keeping that Foley in. And to pull that out, you have to pull a bubble of 10 milliliters of fluid out through a hole the size of a pencil. It always causes trauma. So this gentleman's on there waving around all these bloody tubes, probably not breathing very well because he just pulled out his two chest tubes, you know, from the gunshot wound. Now they're going to have to go in and surgically implant a catheter for another 2 weeks, restrain this gentleman, probably put him in hard restraints, which requires hourly checks. That's going to be a miserable night. That's going to be a miserable night or day, whomever is taking care of that patient. So I feel bad for them. That kind of stuff happens all the time, unfortunately. All right, what do we got next?
Not a nursing story per se, but when I was a tech on the stroke unit, I remember we had this one very elderly, nonverbal man who also had pretty severe kyphosis and was super cachectic. We had him in 2-point restraints because he kept pulling out his peg. He was constantly moaning and trying to pull against the restraints. He was a very sad sight to see if you weren't prepared. I remember walking into the room to turn him and saw this really young guy staring at him, and he was just white as a sheet. I asked him what was wrong and how could I help him, and this poor kid looks at me and says, I'm from such and such, and I'm supposed to serve him papers. I don't remember the exact details anymore, but if I remember correctly, this poor patient's family had to go through some legal process that required serving the patient papers so they could make decisions for him and his care, and this poor legal assistant had to come do it and was not told ahead of time what he was walking into. I sat him in a chair in the hall and went and got the social worker, but this poor kid had this look on his face the whole time. He clearly had a major formative life event with this one.
Lawyers going to the hospital is kind of a weird thing, or a legal team going to the hospital is kind of a weird thing. It's kind of off limits, so I don't know how he got into that. I don't know how he got into that unit to see that, but anytime when you are in the hospital, you are at your worst that you'll ever be at. Typically, you're half naked. This gentleman had kyphosis, which is, you know, slumping of the back. He is in 2-point restraints, meaning he's tied down. So you're slumped in the back and you're tied down, and, you know, tubes and stuff like that. So somebody that's not in the medical profession coming in, it's going to be quite the shocker. And that happens a lot with, like, families as well. Families will come in and just be overwhelmed with everything that's going on. Heck, there's been times that I've been in a hospital room, been overwhelmed with everything's going on. So probably not the best place to serve somebody. And even if they could, this gentleman's obviously not in the right mentation. Any court on earth is going to throw that one out. So that's a weird one. I've never had a lawyer come to the hospital in my experience, but I'm sure they could.
The only person I ever dropped on the job was my director of nursing, who actually was never a nurse. Buckle up. This happened when I was in my first year of nursing school. I got a job as a nursing assistant at a local nursing home. The director of nurses was very nice. She dressed a little odd for an upper manager. A couple of weeks in, and everything is fine. Then I get notified the next day I'm supposed to report to have my skill level assessed, along with a few other new hires. We go into an empty room, and there is our director of nursing in a leotard, and here is where it gets crazy. She plays the part of a resident. She has a simulate doing pericare on her. She tells me to transfer her from the bed to a wheelchair. She licks me across the face, and in shock, I drop her. She tells me I need to be ready for anything. Yeah, but not from my boss. The next guy, she grabs his crotch. We're all really uncomfortable, and I guess she sensed it, and we were dismissed. A week later, I come in for my shift, and there is a lot of commotion in the front office. Police are there. Apparently, the director of nursing was working on a dead nurse's license and had spent the last 10 years going from place to place, job to job, using dead nurse's licenses. She had a half dozen aliases. I'm always very interested when I see a new director of nursing to see if she ever pops up again. Maybe there's a reward. This all happened in 1990.
Okay, that's just crazy that happened. You know, you wouldn't be surprised to hear that from men, like a male superior doing that to female subordinates. But to hear it from a woman is always kind of surprising. And, you know, the reason why is there's not a lot of men in nursing. I think the last statistic I saw was in 2023, there's only 13% of the nurse force is men. And so when you have somebody like this in a position of authority, doing things to men, you just don't hear about that every day. And you know, if it was the other way around, it'd make national news, but it doesn't make news when it happens to men. So I've never been in a situation like that where a female superior, you know, propositioned me in some ways. You know, you hear about men doing that to women all the time, but kind of crazy for that to happen. You know, being a male in nursing, there's certain things that you have to be very cognizant of. You know, this story tells about, you know, her doing pericare. For those of you who aren't nurses, what pericare is literally cleaning the bum and the, you know, perineum and the vagina. It's part of, like, after, you know, somebody goes to the bathroom or something, you want to keep everything down there clean so they don't get infection. So she's in a tight leotard and having this male nurse do pericare. That's weird. There's a story I heard once, and this is a true story, and it actually happened, didn't happen to my friend, but it happened to this doctor who was working at the facility that my friend worked at. And this friend of mine, she's a nurse, and she was working at this hospital in a rural hospital. And this rural hospital had a resident that was going around with this male physician. And this male physician, they're in rural, you know, they're doing their rural residency. And there's not a lot of opportunity to do some things, right? And, you know, when you're in residency as a medical doctor, you have to, you know, experience everything at least once. And so anyways, long story short, they got, you know, this female resident was with this male supervising physician, and they were talking about something that involved testicle torsion, which is the twisting of a testicle or something along those lines. And she's like, I just don't know if I'm ever going to get to see that. And he said, well, we can practice on me. And literally he dropped his drawers and, you know, she did it on him, and apparently it was really benign, and he was doing it from a place of, like, teaching. But anyways, the word got out, and he almost lost his license over that. And he had to have, anytime there was a female in the room, he had to have a chaperone with him. And so he was able to maintain his license, but everywhere he went, he had a chaperone with him. And so they had to pay for somebody to always be with him. And I don't know if it's still going on. I don't know if he was on, like, some sort of, like, period of time where he had to have the chaperone, but it happens. Chaperones are interesting because I still use chaperones today. So a chaperone is obviously somebody that's in the room when you get into a situation where, you know, parts are being shown, right? So I will often be in those scenarios in my practice because I do a lot of aesthetics. So, you know, breasts will come out, or, you know, you'll do some sort of vaginal thing or testicular thing. So I always, always, always grab a chaperone to go in with me to those rooms. But when I was a bedside nurse, there was this time where we had this female patient, and she was a large patient, and she had, I don't remember what condition she had, but she couldn't move very well. And so if you're a nurse, you know this, that you're turning patients every 2 hours to avoid bed sores and pressure ulcers and things of that nature, and to keep them clean and whatnot. And so I had this patient for 3 days straight, 3 nights straight. And I had this, I had a nursing assistant, and I won't name her, you know, to protect her anonymity, but I had a nursing assistant with me. And it was really weird because she was really adamant that somebody would be there in there every 2 hours and turning her, which rightfully so. And I was a fairly new nurse, so every time I went in, I would grab Joyce. And I didn't have in the back of my mind that I needed a chaperone, but I just needed help because she was a big person. So anyways, and I was new, so I was really good at my documentation too, because, you know, they're like, oh, if you don't document it, you didn't do it. So for 3 nights, I'm doing this, and there was nothing weird or anything, but, you know, she's large, and lots of times she's naked, especially when you're, like, listening to hearts and lungs. You've got to put your stethoscope on the chest and things of that nature. And so, you know, I went through my normal routine and, you know, got her clean and all that kind of stuff. But I happened to have a nursing assistant in with me nearly every time that I was in the room, and I charted it. Well, weeks went by. This patient filed a report with the hospital, and she claimed that the male nurses in the hospital were fondling her breast when she couldn't move very well. Now, she had been in a bunch of units. At one point she was in the ICU, and then she came to my unit. And so I get called in. They're like, hey, you need to come in about an hour early today. So, and, you know, working night shift, that's not an easy thing to do because you're just so sleep deprived. And so I went in there, you know, shift starts at 7. I went in there at 6, and they pull me into this room, and I'm like, what is going on? Like, I've got, you know, my nursing director in there and somebody else, and they started asking me questions about this patient. I go, yeah, I remember her very well. It wasn't that long ago, and I just remember her taking so much time for me to work on her. And so they start asking me these questions. Did you ever touch her breast? And I'm like, probably. And like, what do you mean probably? I'm like, well, you have to listen to the heart. And she was a larger woman. And in order to listen to all the different areas of the heart, sometimes you'll have to move a breast away. And she's like, well, how do you move a breast? I'm like, I always use the back of my hand to move the breast, because they teach you that in nursing school. Like, if you use the back of your hand, you know, push tissue away, it's not as, you know, violating as if you use the front of your hand. And so I said, yeah. And I go, I'm sure you can look at my charting. They're like, yeah, you charted every 2 hours on this patient, which it's really hard to chart every 2 hours on a patient, as you're well aware, in a hospital if you're a nurse. Anyways, long story short, she, I don't know what happened, but I was exonerated because I had my nursing assistant in there. I charted that she was in there with me. I had documented that I was in there every 2 hours. I was minding my P's and Q's. I was doing Foley care. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. And I had just been really religious about charting. And that was the end of it, was that. And then at the end of that, I was like, where's this going? You know, she's like, well, she's made accusations that some of the male nurses have been fondling her. And I'm like, well, it wasn't me. So I don't know what happened. Might have just been an accusation. But anyways, you got to protect yourself. You've got to be careful when you are in those situations as a male, especially, because there's that potential that they could misinterpret your actions, you know. And I was always really careful with, like, younger patients, you know, in the hospital, because you see most of your patients naked at some point. You see a butt or a breast or something, you know, as you're assessing these patients or looking at their surgical wounds. They'll often have surgical wounds requiring you to lift gowns and things of that nature. Nobody wears underwear in the hospital, and so you just see things, but you got to be careful. So I feel bad for this guy that his supervisor was the one doing it. But in my situation, that situation I just told you, I got exonerated because of good charting. So always chart.
Want to talk about burnout? This happened about 3 years ago. We were double capacity with 7 schedule holes. Guy comes in and tells registration that he's having chest pain. There's no triage nurse because we're grossly understaffed. He takes a seat in the waiting room and died. One of the PAs walked out crying, saying she was going to quit. This is all going down while I'm bouncing between my pneumonia from a stabbing in one room, my 60/40th retroperitoneal hemorrhage on pressors with no ICU beds in another, my symptomatic COVID in another, and 2 more that were basically ignored.
Short staff and provider burnout. It happens all the time. There's a unwritten rule, and I heard this once. I'm like, this is 100% the way hospitals work. As a leader, you ask yourself, am I overstaffed? Excuse me. As a leader, you ask yourself if you're understaffed. If the answer is no, then you're overstaffed. And that's how hospitals run. They're not understaffed, then they're overstaffed. And then we need to cut some positions. And then situations like this, so this is obviously in the emergency room. Emergency rooms are hard to staff first and foremost because you never know what's going to come through the door. Now, they have historical data to go off of. They know that, you know, between the hours of like 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., you know, nothing much usually happens. So they kind of cut staff down there. But, you know, you can have who knows what happened. And if you have 3 sick calls that day, it's going to be bad. Burnout is the number one reason for leaving your job in healthcare. And in fact, all the burnout literature is usually done on nurses because they have the highest burnout rate. They're overworked, understaffed. They're required to do all sorts of stuff. And they're in a very traumatic industry. I mean, especially in a hospital, these patients die on you, they're mean. You literally deal with people at their worst. It's rewarding when you fix people, but, you know, adding an extra patient, it's just traumatic. And it happens to you fast. I got burned out very quickly. Like at 3 months, I was like, what did I get into? But you have to kind of work through it, and you kind of have to manage stress, and you kind of have to let it go. But it is prevalent. And I think the average nurse stays in their job for 2 to 2.5 years, their first job, before they move on to something less stressful. And the first job is usually like inpatient care. Some nurses stick it out. They love that adrenaline rush and all that. But it can be pretty bad. And then it's really bad for like primary care providers as well. Primary care providers get really burned out, both nurses and, you know, MDs, nurse practitioners and stuff like that. Because again, you're dealing with sick people and it just wears on you. You know, patients don't do what you tell them to do, and, you know, it just wears you out. So as a nurse, you have to have some sort of, stress intervention to get through all that horrible stuff. Because if you bring it home with you, you're not sleeping that night, your family's going to suffer. You have to let it go. So go work out, or there's all sorts of different stuff. My method was, there was a road I crossed on my way home in my car, and I allowed myself to think about the day until that road. And then I would put on gangster rap and stop thinking about it. And that's how I dealt with the stress. And then I get home, and we had a rule: we don't ask how dad's day was at the hospital, because it would just bring back all those bad things. And when I was home, that was my happy place. So that's what I did to address it. But if you don't have a strategy like that, you're not going to last long. So, all right, let's listen to one more.
Today, I had an overweight patient ask me to spread her butt cheeks for her so she could fart. Yeah, no joke.
Okay, that's a funny one. Yeah, you get some pretty interesting requests. This is one of my favorite stories. I haven't shared it on this podcast yet. So, and it just came back to me because of this. We had a patient once, a large patient, who, when I say large, like 500 pound plus, and they really can't take care of themselves. And this patient, I was a new nurse. I was a brand new nurse. And she had a caregiver at her house, and for some reason she had to come in. And I just started my shift, and my nursing assistant came up to me and goes, she needs to have a bowel movement and she needs disimpacted. And I was like, oh no. And I'm like, is that something I can delegate? And my nursing assistant's like, I'm not doing it. You have to do it. So disimpacted means I got to put my finger in there and dig out the hard poo. Because most obese people are very dehydrated, so their poo's very hard. And this woman had just total care. It was just, I mean, just a disaster. So I'm like, okay. And they're like, she's like, well, I'm going to go get her ready. So I go and I open up the room. And when I open up the curtain to the room, she's in a ceiling lift. So all of our rooms had ceiling lifts. So you have this 500-pound woman in a ceiling lift. And she was spread eagle. And I just walk, as soon as I open the curtain, I see that sight of her perineum looking at me, and I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, what in the hell? So I shut the curtain. I'm like, I can't deal with this right now. Like, I got to go psych myself up. So I went back to the nurse's station. I'm like, okay, God, I got to go do this. What am I going to do? I'm like, I got to do this. And then my nursing assistant comes back, and there is a God, because she goes, oh, she was able to poo without you. And I was like, oh, thank you, Jesus. There is a God. I didn't have to put my finger in there. I was so happy. The spread the cheek story. This is a true story with this patient. She had a child, and she had a husband. And physically, I don't know how they could have sex because she was so large. There's a lot of folds and stuff like that. Anyway, so she starts telling me about her miracle child. I go, oh, why is she your miracle child? She goes, well, because of my condition, obesity, it's really hard for my husband to have sex with me. I'm like, okay, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. But she kept going. And I go, okay. And then she starts to proceed me how, to in order to have sex, they had to get their neighbor to come in, hold the folds open so her husband could do the deed. And that's why this was her miracle child. And I'm like, I wanted to ask, how many times did you have to do that? But I was so mortified by the story. I was like, I can't do it anymore. But she had to have a neighbor. Now imagine being that neighbor saying, hey, can you come help us? And you walk into that situation. We need to see you to hold some folds open so we can, you know, get a baby in me. That's a pretty good friend if you're willing to do that. That's a true story. Anyways. All right. Well, that's enough for today. Those are our Dr. John reactions to some of the nurse stories that are out there. We'll do some more of these in the future. There's some crazy stuff that goes on. So we'll see you next time. Have a good day.